My name is Sally Steenland, and I direct the Faith and Progressive Policy Initiative here at the Center for American Progress. With me today is the very Reverend Gary Hall, who is Dean of the Washington National Cathedral here in Washington, D.C. Dean Hall came to the cathedral a year ago last October from Evanston, Illinois, where he was president of Seabury Western Theological Seminary. Dean Hall has served congregations in All Saints Pasadena Church in California, Church of the Redeemer in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, and Christ Church Cranbrook in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan. Dean Hall graduated from the University of California at Berkeley and has a PhD from UCLA. Since coming to the cathedral, Dean Hall has been a strong and prophetic voice for gun violence prevention, LGBT equality, and other important justice issues. So, Dean Hall, thank you very, very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. Thank you.
I'd like to start talking about gun violence prevention, and in particular, a day that is coming up, which is December 14th, and that is the year anniversary of the horrific shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. 2 days after the shooting was a Sunday, and you preached a sermon in the National Cathedral. And in that sermon, you said, and here I'm quoting you, "As people of faith, we can no longer tolerate the epidemic of gun violence in America. We must become the focal point of faithful advocacy of gun control, calling our leaders to courageous action and supporting them as they take it." Why did you preach that sermon?
Oh, my goodness. A number of reasons. First, I was actually homesick the day of the Newtown shooting and was sort of watching it unroll on cable television. And I just had this visceral reaction to it that was almost overwhelming, that it was just one too many major events in that year. If you remember 2012, not that long ago, we had the shooting at the Sikh temple in Wisconsin. We had the shootings in Aurora, that was like the third major mass shooting in that year, not to mention all the other gun violence. And I had been in Chicago, where there is an epidemic of gun violence among teenagers on the south side of Chicago. And I just had this sort of visceral reaction that we had to do something about it, that we just could not tolerate it any longer. So I did preach that sermon, and was really surprised that there was such a strong response to it, both within the cathedral community, but also within the national, both progressive community, but also the faith community nationally and around the world. The Washington National Cathedral is a kind of symbol of faith in America in a way, and to sort of have that cathedral stand unambiguously as opposed to gun violence was a kind of a strong signal that hadn't been heard from this place in a while, so it kind of caught fire. But it essentially was my just strong visceral reaction to this Newtown shooting being the absolute last possible straw that people could take. And I felt like I sort of woke up in that moment, like I'd been sleepwalking through this endless, numbing succession of gun events, and that just was the one that kind of tipped me over into action.
Well, since that sermon, you've been working this past year with many other advocates on gun violence prevention, including Faiths United to prevent gun violence. So, tell us what you've been doing and what groups are asking for.
Well, we've had we have been working with Vinnie DeMarco and Faiths United Against Gun Violence. We did a gun violence prevention Sabbath in the spring last year around St. Patrick's Day time, which is when they do it, and we're going to do another one next spring, which is going to be like a 3-day event here at the cathedral. But then we also invite other faith communities around the country. We had about 100 churches involved online last year. We're trying to triple that if we can for this next year. Marianne Buddy, the Bishop of Washington, my kind of boss and colleague here, she and I have also made the rounds up to Capitol Hill, met with some legislators. I also, because of that sermon and because of my California connections, got invited by Senator Feinstein to lead the to give the invocation and opening statement at the press conference when she announced the assault weapons ban legislation. And so we've done that kind of stuff, working with her and with Chris Van Hollen, the congressman from Maryland, about some of the legislative things. Those have kind of stalled right now, as far as we understand. Working a little bit with the White House, with the Vice President's initiative, and I think we're trying to figure out what the next legislative steps are. But what we've been doing essentially, I think, primarily, is to try to keep the issue visible. But we did sign on early on to the kind of consensual legislative agenda, which was the assault weapons ban, universal background checks, and strict penalties on gun trafficking. And that seemed to be an agenda around which there was a fair amount of actual consensus on both sides of the aisle until the NRA just weighed in late last year and then made it, or early this year, and just made it crazy for people and politicized it in a way it hadn't been. But so at the moment, we've sort of put that stuff on hold, and we're trying to figure out what our next steps are, both in terms of keeping the issue visible, but also trying to figure out how we move the agenda forward more in kind of movable districts and places like that.
What aspects of your efforts stand out as being important? And it could be, I'm going to say a couple, and you might say all of the above, but it's, yes, I pick that. So grassroots organizing sounds like it's important. Educating the public, making them aware, and kind of rousing people that maybe something can be done. And then moral persuasion, you've been lobbying on the Hill, so that's important. Are you scoring votes in terms of certain districts? So what stands out as, if you really want to move the ball, these are things really to focus on?
I think, from my experience this year, that we've got to do a lot of work on lighting a fire under gun safety people. The passion is all on the other side. And it's like when I appeared on the Feinstein press conference on C-SPAN, there's been an organized letter writing campaign. We get letters and emails still daily here criticizing me for being anti-Second Amendment. And so when we have put on events, our attendance here, there was a lot of, you know, when the Newtown shootings occurred, when the Navy Yard shootings occurred, there's a lot of emotion and a lot of outrage and desire to do something. But that doesn't really translate into kind of energy, I don't think, on our side. And the other side is passionate, and they care deeply, and they really are tireless. And so I think in some ways the issue is, and I know there's issues about trying to get money and Bloomberg trying to put money into the congressional races, but I think one of the things the faith community needs to do is to keep this issue visible and to keep talking about it and to try to ignite some passion under the people that really favor gun violence prevention legislation. I mean, between 70 and 80% of the American public support the things we're advocating, but they don't show up both to rallies, and they don't show up to put pressure on their legislators and that kind of thing. So I think the first thing that the faith community needs to do is really just keep the issue visible and to really, again, as you say, make the moral case. I mean, this is not a morally neutral issue. If you step back as a person of faith and look at this question, this is not ambiguous for Christians and Jews and Muslims and Buddhists and Sikhs and Hindus. I mean, there is no argument for violence or for terrorizing people. And so in across the whole spectrum of religious faith, it seems to me this is a very clear issue for people of faith. And we've just got to sort of make that a big issue. So I think that's one thing that we just have to put at the top of our agenda. I do think there's a lot of work to do, and this is what some of our visits to the Hill have been about, is working with the Democratic leadership, because the Republican leadership just won't talk to us, but working with the Democratic leadership about where identifying the people who are movable and how to get churches in their districts to not only put pressure on them, but also to send them the message that they're going to support them. I mean, that's the kind of the twofold message I've been trying to send, is not only are there people that care about this, but we'll be there for you if you actually have some courage, you know, because I think sometimes we can be better about trying to put pressure than we can be about letting people know that we're going to support them. So I think the second thing is really trying to do just the organizing around these districts where there are movable members of Congress that we might actually, both senators and congresspeople, to do that. And then I think the third thing is the grassroots organizing, is trying to use churches and synagogues and temples as places to organize people at the grassroots.
I want to follow up on that for a minute. When you're talking about this, a small, relatively small concerted effort of fervent people can get something done.
Right.
If it's the first, if it's what gets them up in the morning and it's top of their list, versus a much larger majority of people for whom it's not the top thing on their list, for that fervent minority of people, what's it about? I mean, is it about guns, or is it, or is there either an unconscious or an unspoken something there that, unless we address it or dismantle it or talk about it in a different way, we're just not going to get to the root of what is really at stake here, or what people think, mistakenly think, is at stake here?
You know, that's a really interesting question. When I've the bishop and I have gone to two meetings here in the Episcopal Diocese of Washington with Episcopalian gun owners, because our diocese extends to rural Maryland, and so there are a lot of Episcopalian gun owners, both in the city but also in the rural areas. And it's so interesting that when I talk to proponents of gun safety, the conversation is always about empathy for the victims.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk to these gun owners, and I'm trying to be not be judgmental here, the conversation is always about, you're trying to take something away from me that I deserve.
Right, right.
And so, and it's almost, in other words, it's almost like a bifurcated question.
Mm-hmm.
The gun control people are all, you know, I first got involved in gun control stuff in the 90s when I was working at All Saints in Pasadena, when three young boys were shot to death on Halloween night, trick-or-treating, by a drive-by shooting, and our congregation came together, and we put pressure on the city and the state and everything to do some gun control legislation. So I've been involved in this work for 20 years, but I got into it because I my heart bleeds for the people who are, and the kids, both, you know, in mass shootings, but also in daily urban shootings, who are being gunned down. And that's my experience of church people, is it's their empathy that is called out. My experience of the Second Amendment fundamentalists is that they are, because no one's really arguing about the Second Amendment here, they're arguing about whether it can be regulated or not.
Right.
Which is what the Supreme Court said in the Heller decision, was that it was a right, but it was a right that could be regulated like free speech could be regulated.
Sure.
So, but what they, the argument, the psychology in that community is always, you're trying to take something away from me that I deserve, and I will be vulnerable if you take it away from me. I never hear a lot of concern about the people that are being shot.
Yeah.
I hear a lot of essentially self-interested language about my own vulnerability. I think the good news in this, if you look at the statistics, I mean, here's my other I say this as a 64-year-old white man, but, you know, us aging white males seem to be part of the problem. And in some ways, the gun, if you look at the statistics about the NRA, their membership numbers are going down year after year.
Wow.
The numbers of people who own guns are going down. The numbers of guns sold are going up, but it's people buying multiple guns rather than more people buying guns. So in some ways, that the NRA faces the same demographic challenges as, say, the Republican Party faces, as frankly something like the mainline churches face, in that there is a kind of demographic shift around a generational shift going on. And so I think there's also some panic in that movement, because they know in some sense that time is against them, that younger people are just not buying guns in the same way that the boomers are, and the World War II generation. I mean, so there's some good news in that for us, but I think there is some, there's a lot of fear in that group, and I don't know where the fear comes from. It's the same kind of fear you hear in all the anger about the health, you know, Affordable Care Act and other things, but I don't know much more about the psychology, but they are extremely, extremely passionate.
Yeah, and it is kind of sad when you think about it. I mean, it's maybe the end result of feeling like, I'm in this on my own. We're not in this together. And you're not going to look out for me, so I got to look out for myself. A kind of an isolated feeling of, you know, social systems or government or whatever, you know, is not there for you. And so, you know, it's like you're on the frontier, you need your gun.
Right. And I have a hard time. It's like when, and if you remember that thing, there was that shooting a couple of years ago in the Empire State Building, in front of the Empire State Building, where 9 people were shot by police kind of fire.
It wasn't
a police brutality thing. It was just, these were trained marksmen who couldn't hit the people they were shooting at. And so there's all this, like, yes, we need guns so we can take down these awful marauders, but that's like this illusion that you're going to actually be a sharp enough and disciplined enough shot to actually shoot the person you're aiming at, you know. So there's just all this craziness about it. I also think, and this is, here I'm going out on a limb as a social theorist, I lived in Michigan for a long time, and it's always interesting that 30 miles from where I live, you could cross the Canadian border, and there would be, their attitude towards guns was entirely different than our attitude towards guns in America. And I used to teach American literature and American intellectual history. I think that it's hard to decouple guns from slavery, I think. I think that a part of our part of the reasons we held on to guns so much is that so much of our early history had to do with trying to control a population that really didn't want to be here. And I had some conversation with some military historians over the summer who were telling me that in the Confederate Army, one of the reasons the South believes it lost the Civil War is that they had to keep 2 out of every 5 soldiers back home to control the slave population.
So they
were fighting with only 3/5 of their armed forces actually at the battle at the front. And so I think Canada and America are the same culture basically, but Canada didn't have the slave culture that we had.
Yeah.
And so I think our own ambivalence about slavery and our own inability to examine race and slavery questions and our own implications in that, especially as white people, I think that's tied into this somehow.
Yeah.
And it makes it vexed in a way that that feels that we haven't really been able to lift the lid on it entirely.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right about that. And I would just add to that popular culture, you know, Hollywood from the 50s with the cowboys and the Indians, you know, the glorification of, you know, on your saddle shooting versus, you know, somebody with a bow and arrow. And it was the guns that, you know, let the cowboys, you know, take over the frontier. So there's that kind of idealization and valorization of of guns, you know, and cowboys and all the rest of that.
It's like a it's like the civilizing tool that we have.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
The savages. Yeah, exactly.
No, I think that's probably right. So it has a place in our imagination, in our corporate imagination and psyche that makes it. I mean, there's great movies like Winchester 73, which is a James Stewart movie with about a man. It's just about a rifle. It's just about the 73 Winchester.
The name of the movie is the name of the
gun. Winchester 73 is the name of the movie, and it's a great Western from the 50s, and it's all about how the role that the Winchester 73 played in the and then there's a great, you know, Richard Slotkin, the guy who wrote Regeneration Through Violence, you know, in the 60s, which is a history of about how in American culture, people basically regenerate themselves through violence. And he looks through all the various sort of beginning with the Puritans and wars on the Indians, and then all the way through the Civil War and the, as you're saying, the war on the frontier and the cavalry, and through the Vietnam War, that are there's this sort of underlying myth in our culture that we regenerate ourselves through violence, and so I think there's a way in which violence is very close to our psyche as a people, and it's hard for us to. It's hard for us to disentangle ourselves from that.
You know, you're absolutely right about that. You know, the kind of heroic loner hero with his gun on his horse or whatever. But at the same time, I just want to say, you know, that may exist in the imagination, but the reality, I do think we have reality on our side in the sense, this was several months ago when I don't recall what state it was, or the city, where there are open carry laws, and a bunch of guys took their assault weapons and went to a farmer's market on a Saturday with their guns. And they scared the pants off everybody. And it was a reasonably conservative place. But just imagine, you know, you're with your kids, you've got your dog, you're looking at lettuce and tomatoes, and there are these guys with these mega strapped assault weapons. And so nobody feels safer with that. Nobody relaxes around that. And they try to get the police to get them out of there so that they could enjoy the farmer's market. But in fact, it was legal.
Sure.
So, you know, there's that disconnect in terms of, does that make you feel safer? No, it doesn't. So,
but I think I'd say the other thing, though, is I think that that's a really interesting story. I heard another story about in Texas, I believe it was, a group of women who were pro gun control had a meeting at like a coffee place. That was a public meeting, and because there was this open carry thing, a bunch of gun owners showed up and just stood around with their guns.
Yes.
To essentially intimidate them. But the court ruled that that was speech, you know, that was a First Amendment
speech,
right for them
yeah.
to display their guns. And so there is this, and I think most people, the other thing is I've never, you know, I've never been in a place where someone's been shot, so I've never actually experienced or seen a shooting. But from what I understand, especially from people that have, I know a number of people that have worked in emergency rooms, and they say when you see a gunshot victim, now, I mean, the bullets we have now and the weapons we have now, essentially, you don't survive gunshot wounds today the way people did even 20, 30 years ago. And so most people that are shot arrive at the emergency room dead.
Yeah.
But the people I know that have worked in those places say when you see a gunshot victim, you will become a total gun control advocate immediately because of the carnage.
Yeah.
And I think this is an abstract conversation for a lot of people. You know, the people I know that have been in the military and have seen warfare are very pro gun control.
Right.
I don't think I've met a military person that, I mean, I've met one or two, but the way far preponderance of military people, police, anybody who's actually had any experience with weapons are very much in favor of gun safety and of gun regulation. Because they've seen the effects of it, and I think a lot of people are hearing these arguments in this kind of abstract void, and they, you know, again, they saw people on, you know, when I was a kid, people died on TV without any blood. You know, they'd be shot, and they'd fall to the floor, and there was no blood on the floor.
Right, you know? Right. Well, to your point, I think that one of the reasons faith leaders are such a powerful voice is it's the moral argument, but also so many faith leaders are on the front lines of this and are burying, you know, members of their congregation are just seeing this, as you were saying, when you were at All Souls in Pasadena. These are witnesses on the front lines in terms of the carnage of what's happening in their communities and speak with an authenticity that's really important. I just have one or two more questions.
Sure.
I think this was at the press conference. I'm not sure it was in your sermon, but you had this very memorable phrase where you said the gun lobby is no match for the cross lobby. And I just want to ask you to talk about that a little bit, just sure. especially in light of the fact that it is easy to be discouraged because it's been a year of a lot of losses, despite, as you say, overwhelming public support for common sense gun regulation and really effective coalition work. So how do you not get discouraged, and talk about the cross lobby?
Well, that's that was in the sermon, and I it's sort of the phrase I will probably be remembered for the rest of my life. But that was intentional in the sense that as a Christian person, one of the reasons that I take this whole issue so seriously is that the person I follow, Jesus, died at the hands of state violence, right? So that the cross is our symbol as Christians. But it's a symbol, basically, that calls us into compassion and empathy with victims of violence. And so that's not only true of Christians. I mean, certainly Jews have experienced great suffering, and their Jewish scriptures, like the book of Job, are full of great inquiries, investigations into the problem of suffering, and the same with Islam and the other great religions. But I think especially for Christians, the whole issue of the suffering of the innocent, which is in many ways the definition of evil, the whole call to stand with and for victims of suffering and of evil is really central to what our faith is about. And so calling us the Cross Lobby in some sense was intentional because I wanted to put the cross at the center of the conversation. Because this is not just about, I mean, this is a, I mean, I'm a progressive person and I've got all kinds of progressive issues I care about, but this is a theological issue for me. This is a religious issue for me. So I think it goes to the core of what Christianity is about, and I would argue also all the great faith traditions are about. I think we shouldn't be discouraged because, you know, the old King thing about the arc of the universe bending towards justice. I mean, you think again of apartheid and civil rights and women's issues and LGBT issues. I mean, just think about the long march that oppressed people have been on and the real strides we've made in the 20th and 21st centuries about justice for women and LGBT people and people of color and all that. I mean, certainly we have a lot of issues on human trafficking, and slavery is a gigantic concern now, it seems to me, and these violence issues and economic justice issues are also important. So it's not like we've accomplished anything by everything by any means. But I do think that, again, because this issue is so central to our identification as people of faith, and because our experience over the last century has been that when we mobilize and organize, we really do have the power to change things. I am ultimately hopeful about this. I mean, in the short term, I know it's going to be a real slog, because the NRA is both organized and funded, but also is sort of, you know, they're in their kind of reptilian death throes in a way, you know, and so they're frantic and up against the ropes in a way, and so it is going to be a hard slog in the next decade. But I'm ultimately hopeful about it because, again, I've just seen in my own lifetime how we've really made a lot of progress when we're really up against. We're really standing for something that's central to our faith, and we're really up against a kind of an hysterical opposition. It seems to me that the history's on our side, and so I'm hopeful about it. No less committed to organizing, but really hopeful about where it's going to come out.
And then finally, as you and all of us take next steps in this coming year and the next decade, as you say, and as we started the interview with December 14 marking the year anniversary, tell us how you at the Cathedral and others will be marking that anniversary.
Well, the Newtown Action Alliance is, we're partnering with them to have a vigil on December 12th. 3:45 in the afternoon to mark the anniversary of the shooting, and we're really doing that in a less reflective reflective and contemplative way than a kind of call to action way. I mean, this is a day with the Newtown families essentially to mark the one-year anniversary and to just hold up the victims of that shooting in a way, in a kind of liturgical way in the cathedral space. So that will be going on. And then we are going to have, again, our gun violence prevention Sabbath next March, in the middle of next March, here at the cathedral, in our partnership with Faith United Against Gun Violence. And that will be a nationwide event that we hope to get hundreds of congregations across the country to be with us. And we're also going to try to use the cathedral's building as a kind of visual symbol during that period to kind of light it in such a way that will hold up, make the kind of our concern for gun violence, and also to hold up the numbers of people who have died since Newtown, a kind of visual marker in the cathedral's fabric. So, and then the ongoing organizing work with Faith United, which I'm working more and more closely with myself, will be our basically our kind of grassroots work for the next year.
Well, blessings and good luck and good energy and wishes to you. And thank you very, very much for talking to us today.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Sally. And thank you for all you do.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.